Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show by talking with you about foster parenting. Our guest, Oriana Carey, is CEO of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, a statewide organization based in West Allis. And as we talk with Oriana, I hope you'll join in. Have you been a foster parent? Are you thinking of becoming a foster parent? Maybe you were a child with foster parents. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Oriana Carey, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you more about this topic. So thanks for having me.
Well, let's start by talking about foster care, maybe a definition. I mean, I think we all have a sort of a general notion, but is there some sort of official definition of foster care or foster parenting?
Sure. So officially, I guess what if you want to say official, what we say is that, the definition, foster care is intended to be temporary care for children who cannot live with their parents because of safety concerns. Children who are in foster care can be living with relatives. They can be living with people that are like relatives, or often what I think we understand being non-relative foster parents or people who choose to become a foster parent, get licensed, trained, etc.
Yeah. So the responsibility of a foster parent, I mean, it's being the parent in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think, when we look at that, we can go down your typical list of things like, welcoming a child in your home, having things they need, a place to stay, bedroom, making sure that, they're getting to medical or mental health appointments they need, making sure to the degree possible, we like to keep kids within their same school setting, and working through the various appointments often that end up being a part of children who end up as part of our system. What I think is not always as clearly understood, and what is sometimes, and we're trying to spend more and more time with this, with families in general, is that a really big responsibility is keeping children connected to their parents, which means building a relationship with people that you might not naturally have considered you build a relationship for. And that's important because anybody who has any experience with some kind of a shared parenting relationship knows that youth don't want to be between the adults, and if our main goal is for somebody to be reunified and going back home, we can't have months and years of, relationship that's broken apart. So to the degree possible, how can we keep that relationship and that connection with their family intact?
Yeah, I went online to your website, which was, I found it very interesting. Maybe you could talk about the mission of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families and how you fit in.
Yeah, so where do we fit in, in this whole complex ecosystem is what we like to say of navigating these systems of care. So the Coalition is an independent nonprofit with over a 40-year history of working alongside families who have been involved in caring for a relative, adoption, foster care.
and helping them navigate that complexity. You know, so it can be simple things like, how do I become a foster parent? What happens around adoption? You know, I just had my grandchild placed with me. These simple things, or to incredibly more complex issues where I need to find a trauma-informed therapist. I'm really having difficulty in my house. So to do that mission, we have people who answer the phone. We write an incredible amount of content. You said you were on one of our websites. Yeah,
really interesting.
We provide training, live webinars monthly, and then all that content is accessible via recording or a learning management system we have. Our team helps, counties consider their recruitment efforts. We advocate both at, state, local level, with our legislature, things that we see, or at least, trying to just provide a sort of a balanced perspective on all the issues involved.
The coalition, as you said, has been around for a while. Have there been changes over time in the way we look at foster care?
Well, yeah. I mean, really, when we, the roots of this organization, began because children were lingering in foster care. And that was, mid-80s timeline. Well, when you look at that, part of it is there was a belief once we had a belief that, if you were a foster parent, you shouldn't develop too much of a relationship with this child. You could not be the potential adoptive resource. You were just trying to, and we know that's just not possible. And then I think, nationally, statewide, historically, in the 90s, there was a big piece of legislation that put in timelines of how long, it was called the Adoption and Safe Families Act, how long children could spend in the foster care system before child welfare needed to start being really clear about what was going to be the end game. If reunification wasn't going to happen, were we talking about adoption? And what happened in there is you built this really big influx of, children moving into adoption quite rapidly. And I think what is starting to show as people, we like to say with lived experience, share their voice of their experiences, that there may have been some unintended consequences of some of that. Some breaking of sibling relationships, breaking of family relationships, families not having enough support and preparation for helping support children who've experienced trauma and who need extra support. And we're still catching up with that today. In 2018, the federal government once again looked at everything and said, and what's funny is that some of this has always been the goal. Like I said, always the goal has been reunification. So, in 2018, we said we better be taking a stronger look at this part about keeping families out of our system to begin with, that we're creating more harm. We're creating another trauma for a child. And so what can we do? And part of that impetus is that when we look at data, we see a really large number of children and teens coming into our system for neglect versus what I think the public might think, traditionally, this really abusive, physically or sexually abusive situation happened. Those numbers are not necessarily rising. It's a misunderstanding in the area of neglect. And I think it's a very complex challenge for our communities to figure out, okay, is this, what's really going on here? How do we help with affordable housing and jobs and enough access to mental health and substance abuse so that we don't have to keep pulling families apart?
Yeah, and there is a trend, if I'm not mistaken, away from non-relative foster care to placing kids with relatives.
Yes, yes, that has. I mean, you know, this is another piece of, you know, there's a whole piece of relatives caring for children in this country, some being directly involved with our child welfare system, and some, as many of us might know, relatives down the street that are caring for someone in their family, and they may not have ever gotten involved with our child welfare system. But specifically within our system, we want to have kids stay with people they know. You know, we've begun to understand that separation, by going in with people you don't have a previous relationship with, creates a lot of stress and anxiety, another trauma in their life. Whereas when I'm with a relative, some of that might be mitigated. However, you know, we don't necessarily, we still, whether it's relatives, non-relatives, adoptive, foster, whatever you're talking about, we are struggling both as a state and nationally to find enough supports for people to care for children who have complex needs.
Yeah. And there are, I mean, there are several thousand. I saw one number, something like 8,000 children in foster care. Is that close or here in Wisconsin?
Yes. So I just, before we got on here, I just looked at, you know, the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families has a dashboard where they keep, you know, just-in-time data. So as of today, their number is 6,005 children. But, you know, that's a point-in-time piece.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we know is it is trending down because our state is working really hard at the local level of trying to put other supports in place so that we don't have to get involved in the lives of children and families where we don't belong.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. If you're going to be a foster parent, I mean, there's a program, and I was online, it takes, you can get some training, or you need to get training to become one.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in Wisconsin, there are a couple different paths that people usually take. You know, each one of our local county organizations that manage child welfare for that particular county license foster parents. We also have private agencies who work either under contract with that county or are providing what is called treatment foster care, a higher level of foster care, that license. And our tribal nations also license foster parents. Typically, they are going to be looking for people with a background, you know, having Native American heritage and have you. So we talk to people about some of those general pieces, like help direct them, you know. So, for example, if somebody talks to one of my team today and they live in Washington County, let's just say that, you know, we're going to connect them. We're going to give them an information packet. We're going to connect them. We're going to ask them if they want to talk directly to the person in Washington County that does that work. And then we're going to be available for them to call back with questions. Typically, then what happens is, depending on the size of the county, you know, in Wisconsin, we have a diverse range.
Sure.
So, you know, some might just be a one-on-one conversation. Some might send people to what are called an information meeting to talk more about foster care within their agency. And then, yes, there are levels, there's a base level of training that people have to have. Again, sort of that, how you're coming in to provide care. Some of those relatives that I talked about, Some choose to take that, you know, tier one, tier two of foster parent licensing because, you know, reimbursement and some of the other pieces that are involved. And then people have to take the beginning training that is offered by the state of Wisconsin, regulated on what those core courses. And then within every 2 years, based on the type of license you have, there's more training that you have to take. It's called ongoing training. And the coalition under contract with the Department of Children and Families, which is called the Wisconsin Family Connection Center, has those trainings I talked about. A lot of foster parents, a lot of relatives, adoptive parents who are needing or wanting more of that education are the ones that take those trainings we offer each month.
Oriana Carey, our guest today, is CEO of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, a statewide organization based in West Allis, talking about foster parenting. Questions for her? Maybe you've got an experience to share, or maybe just have a general question about becoming a foster parent. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at foster parenting today with our guest Oriana Carey from the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families. And I hope you'll join in as we move along today. Questions or maybe an experience to share? The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And just to note, at noon today, we're taking a look at saving for retirement. But right now, we're talking fostering, becoming a foster parent. You know, I'm going back here in time a little bit, maybe 30 years ago when I bought my first house. Right across the street was a family. They were fostering a really nice young child, a young kid. And one Saturday, I looked out and he was sitting on the porch. And I didn't pay any attention to it on his porch across the street. And then I happened to go out to mow the lawn, I think. And he was, this is several hours later, and he's still sitting on the porch. And another day or two later, I ran into the foster parent, and I said, gee, he was just sitting out there a long time. And she said, well, he was waiting for his mother to come. She was supposed to come, and she never did come. And he sat there many, many hours waiting, And I asked her how she handled it, and I don't recall exactly what she said, but I hope she said something like what you had on your website for help for people. Yeah, in that specific situation, I thought it was close to what she said, that's kind of one of the challenges, I guess, when you're a foster parent.
Yeah. So, wow. Let me try to unpack some of that. You know, yes, we do have times where, you know, youth in care are waiting. And thank you, Larry, for pointing that out, because it's back to my original point of like, whatever we might think of somebody's family or the choices they made, for kids, that connection is always there. And, you know, why somebody might wait can be as unique to that situation. You know, what we do know is that, you know, it's also very challenging and scary for that mom, you know?
Yeah.
Does this young person remember me anymore? Or depending on what happened, you know, when we're talking about things with mental health, substance abuse, either somebody's having a situation that maybe happened that they're having a relapse, or they're still working through some of the shame and some of the difficult pieces they're feeling, you know? So yeah, then I'm just bringing up to you earlier in this conversation, like, and then we want foster parents to do this and not be typical humans that want to be mad on behalf of that child or sad or want to do something about that. That's a human reaction, right? Like, oh my goodness, I sat here and let this person go through pain. I hope what happened and what you remembered is, you know, the families we know who have successfully helped kids and their parents navigate this is that they just honor that piece. You know, they check in with kids and youth and they see what they immediately need in that moment. And sometimes the person needs space. Sometimes the outcome, you know, can be that there's some challenging emotions and behaviors behind that. And I think for, again, the people who do this very successfully have learned to be incredibly flexible and, you know, emotionally regulated themselves. Because, you know, another person doesn't need now another person having an emotional reaction to my emotional reaction, right? And so that's a lot of the training emphasis that, you know, goes into this is, you know, talking about trauma, trauma-informed care, understanding how someone who's experiencing that level of disappointment, loss, and separation and how they might react to that.
Yeah. And not blaming or running down the parent that's involved was one thing that I noted. You don't want to put an artificial barrier between the child and the actual parent.
Yeah, and their parent, yes. And, you know, so that's another reason where, you know, the Coalition, the Wisconsin Family Connection Center, our other agency, Catholic Charities of La Crosse, runs, you know, helps cooperate that with us. You know, we're all here to hear, talk about, you know, provide training, provide support groups, connect people to other families like them. Our team specifically here, there's more of us now that I like to say have been a foster and or adoptive parent than there's those of us who have not.
Yeah.
We have several staff here. And so, you know, we're available because that, while we can say, here's how you should act, you know, human beings are not robots. They need somebody else to connect with and say, wow, this happened. Here's how I handled it. Did I handle it right? But I'm having all kinds of emotions. I don't know what to do. And, you know, our team here is here to normalize and help guide people through those challenging, complex situations.
What are, in your mind, what are the benefits of being a foster? What do you get out of being a foster parent? What are the benefits of being a foster parent?
You know, what families tell us and people who work with me, you know, it's this amazing, you know, journey towards seeing that you can do more than you really thought you had, you know, you were able to. Families who have children, you know, birth children of their own will say that they feel that their kids have developed more empathy and understanding and compassion. I always say that if you work really well, and again, this is through the voices of families we know, is that your circle of people grows. Your circle of people grows. And I think, you know, that myth of there's always been these sayings like, I can't foster because I don't want to give them back or it would hurt too much. Well, that's why we're trying now to work through those pieces of, you know, make that connection with the whole the child's family, the whole pieces of that child, and let somebody build that trusting relationship with you so that you are a lifelong resource. And what many families also know is that whether it's for a short time or for a longer period of time, you know, I'm having an impact that I might not know till later, you know, in life.
It's got to be emotionally fulfilling.
It really can be, because you're pushing, you know, you're giving back in a way that doesn't have like these big accolades in life, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if we can help keep families together, if we can help connect children and help them have vital connections in life, you know, we have a more thriving workforce in the future, thriving communities. These are the things that I often talk about, you know, with people who are not necessarily directly fostering.
I want to go to Bradley in Whitewater and hear Bradley's experiences. Thank you for calling, Bradley.
Yes, hello. So my wife and I decided to have a family through fostering. And we started with we went through the classes and brought two brothers into our home. And then it was 11 months later, their mother had another child, which we brought home from the hospital day two, a little girl. And then 4 years after that, there was a fourth child that the same mother had. And we also brought that daughter home from the hospital day two. So it was quite a whirlwind. And a couple things that I want to point out. First of all, the individuals that did the training for us to be foster parents, they did an amazing job. They really tried to prepare us. But I will say this, there's no such thing as being prepared enough, because you know, they say over and over again, every family is different. Every child is different. It's very, very true. You don't know how big your support system needs to be until you're kind of in the middle of it. So however big your support system is, think about doubling it, because that's the kind of support that you're going to need, just because emotionally, it's a roller coaster. There are wonderful rewards, but there are immense challenges that nobody can foresee that come along. So I just, like, people ask me all the time, they know my experiences, my wife and I, and they'll be like, oh, well, I've thought about that. That's fine. You can think about it, but you need to really know what you're getting in for, and you need to be prepared for, like, for you to go to counseling as well, because there's probably a lot of stuff that you need to deal with as, here's my expectations of what I think it's going to be to be a parent. You throw about half of that out the window, because it's a very different situation than anybody else's family.
Mm. And you adopted the children.
We did. We were able to adopt all four kiddos, and we were quite fortunate. They all have the same mom, and to be able to keep them together, we take a lot of pride in the fact that we were able to keep that sibling group together to this day. And there, like I said, there's been amazing joy that has come with that's how we grew our family. But we've got two of the kiddos that have special needs and some learning disabilities, and there's still some struggles. The other piece I wanted to bring up is, don't be afraid. I mean, you're going to want to be an advocate for these kids, especially in the school system. Don't be afraid to kind of push back if the school system is not meeting your expectations. And don't be afraid to go out and get a private diagnosis, like a neuropsych from a doctor, because oftentimes the school systems, even if they do a great job, they don't have the resources to give a full diagnosis like the medical professionals do.
Bradley, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate, well, what you did, but also for calling and giving us your perspective. And Oriana, comments on Bradley's
experience. Well, I want to first start by saying exactly what you just said, Larry. I want to thank Bradley for, you know, calling in, because, you know, there's been part of me through part of this interview are like, oh, I should have had one of my other team members. But so thank you, Bradley. Yeah, I think a lot of the pieces that cross over in some of what Bradley's talking about are some of the immense challenges that we have right now in children's mental health. You know, not only here in Wisconsin, but across the country, you know, and it is difficult for any parent who is navigating our school systems when we need additional things in place. And I would also comment that, you know, I have several staff who have played both roles, right? They've fostered, adopted, they've also been teachers. And it's complex. That's a whole, we could do a whole show on, you know, children's mental health and some of our school issues. But I appreciate so much, Bradley, that you called in and said, yeah, there's this advocacy role that, you know, you have to play and you have to be willing to speak up. You know, in some situations where it's not like Bradley's, where, you know, they've adopted, but where parents are still involved, another big piece that happens with foster parents is helping empower those parents in school settings. That is really, really difficult. And for many of our birth parents, they didn't have the best experience with schools. And now they need to, you know, all those pieces. And many of our families that engage with us will say, you know, I had to help mom and dad as much as I had to help kids understand, you know, what they needed to have a successful education. And it is difficult. It is difficult for all of us, our school systems as well, who are just trying to do the best they can. And, you know, it's always been a challenge in our population. And now, you know, we know that children's mental health overall is a big concern in this state. And, you know, we work as an organization, for example, we try to work really closely with those systems like the Office of Children's Mental Health here in Wisconsin.
Thank you again, Bradley. Appreciate it very much. Someone else is wondering, is there a financial role or part of this if you're foster parenting? Does the state or somebody or the Fed provide some financial support to help you with that task?
Yeah, so I'm glad that you asked that as well, Larry. Yes, there are, you know, there is a monthly stipend that goes to families based on two things, the level of their license, you know, and their and how that was rated up in the front end, as well as the difficulty of needs of the child or teen that's placed with them. And there are formulas that go into all of that work. What I will say is often, regardless of how high some people might think that payment is, it often can fall short for some families when people have lots and lots of extra needs. So it is a balance, and you know, so yes, there is support and help, and no, I do not believe people get rich off of foster care.
No. It didn't look like it to me anyway. I food and clothing and everything else, it adds up in a hurry.
Yeah.
It adds up in a hurry. Someone else wondered, what happens when the kids are sort of age out?
Mm. Right. And so that is that other, you know, really difficult piece of what happens, you know, when in our systems of care. In that, and what that term means is that in Wisconsin, you know, somebody is under the care of the state through age 18, possibly 19, where there are some special circumstances. And then, you know, if you were not adopted or a guardianship, or, you know, you can be left pretty much primarily on your own. you know, and to navigate difficult things. Now, let's think about that for a minute. You know, many people right now, I'm one of them. I have a 20-year-old living still with me.
Yeah.
You know, many of us have that happening. But think about being 18 and alone and trying to figure out and find health insurance and housing and all the things you need right now. And even for youth that are able to get into some post-secondary ed, think about holidays and times when you don't have people to go back to. So that can be a very lonely place. There are services in place in Wisconsin to help mitigate all of that. But really, what we really want is we want youth to have people that are connected for them lifelong, regardless.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, you gave your case there of, you know, you've still got what was the foster kid still there with you, and I hope I hope that can be the case for a lot of these youngsters.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult for the youth, and let me clarify, my child is is my birth child, I'm trying to paint the picture that many of us in our family situations, even with kids outside of foster care, kids are staying at home a lot longer.
Yeah.
And think about what we're expecting of these youth who've experienced trauma and separation and a lot of the other things. I think the challenge is, when you're 18 and you've had disappointment over disappointment, you don't want to hang out with many of us anymore. You know, we're a disappointing bunch, I think, at times for those youth.
Oh, man. Oriana Carey, CEO of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, talking with her today about foster care, and invite you to join in again. Maybe you've got an experience to share, or maybe a question. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at foster care for children in our state today, and an organization that is helping a lot in this fostering area is the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, a statewide organization based in West Allis. Oriana Carey is the CEO and is our guest today. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. Oriana, is there an average length of stay in foster care? I imagine it's all over the place, but.
Yeah, there, you know, it is kind of, as you just said, what our state systems look at is, how do we keep that length of stay short and reasonable for the individual case involved? You know, Adoption and Safe Families Act that I mentioned earlier originally was looking at 12 to 18 months. You know, a decision on this permanency needed to happen. And while all of that is still the case, the reality of the situation is, when you're talking about something like somebody recovering from substance use and that sort of thing, there are advocates in that domain that would say that timeline is too short. So often there is a tension between folks who say children can't be lingering forever, advocates for the parents. And what we're trying to do right now is take a look at it from a whole family approach, and how can we shorten those time frames, have children reunited with their families, and not just reunited, but that, you know, they all have the supports in place they need to be successful and thrive.
I'm wondering how often the hope is, I would guess, that they go back, the child goes back to its birth family after a stay in foster care. What needs to happen for children to be placed back with their families?
Well, once somebody is involved in our child welfare system, what I think a lot of folks don't understand, while there are social workers involved, this system is taken care of by legal or laws, a legal system behind that. So there are a whole lot of folks involved. The social workers involved have an incredibly important job in trying to help that family get all the services and things they need to be able to be reunited. They also have to give that information on to the lawyers and judge and all those people involved. And ultimately, a judge needs to look at the case and say, yep, you have, they're called meet the conditions for return home. And, you know, those are very specific to the case. You know, some of the standard things are things like taking a parenting class, resolving the issues that created the risk to begin with, a whole host of things. And what we're trying to look at now is that list of conditions more challenging for somebody to achieve than what we would expect of those of us who have never been involved?
Yeah.
You know, I think that for some of us who've never been involved in child welfare, if we had to meet some of those conditions, we might, and keep a job, right? Yeah. So work and find transportation and sustainable housing and those sorts of things, we might be challenged as well.
What happens if the child is unable to return to their birth family? Then,
well, in many cases, you know, so first of all, I would say, and I want to make sure we're clear that in Wisconsin, you know, we have a reunification percentage that, you know, hovers around 60%, sometimes lower, sometimes higher. You know, we're doing a really good job of, you know, making that happen. In many of the cases that that can't happen, then we're talking about either doing the next legal step, which is a guardianship with a relative, or it could even be with that foster parent, you know, saying that I'm going to be the legal guardian, or as you heard Bradley speak about earlier, you know, the court case of terminating somebody's parental rights and moving towards adoption.
So those are the options. Let's take a look at the what it takes to be a foster parent. And I mean, eligibility here, is there, the age range is pretty broad, if I'm not mistaken, yep. As an example.
Yep, the age range is broad, starting at 21. There are, so when I started to talk about that process in the beginning, you know, about getting connected with one of those agencies that license foster parents, you know, there are many steps they're going to take. There's application processes. They're going to do what's called a home study, meaning they're going to interview you and your partner and other folks in the home. They're going to look at how you work as a family, what your home is laid out as. They're going to look, do you have enough square footage and space and, you know, ability to do this. They're going to run criminal background checks on you, and they're going to look at all of the things, you know, in your history, you know, for, you know, to see if all of those things measure up. And really, most importantly, really talk to people about their intention, their motivation. And as Bradley said, you know, we sit at tables often throughout the state and we try to talk about, oh, how can we prepare for this? Or how can we sit, you know, and some of it is just like all parenting. Until you are in the thick of stuff, you know, it's really hard to know. And that's why organizations like ours is so vital, because people need, like, oh, wow, that thing that you said was going to happen is happening. you know, and what's nice about our organization is that, yes, people can call back to the county agency and they spend a lot of time with their licensing staff, you know, but sometimes those folks are really have very high workloads. And B, sometimes I don't want to talk to that person because I don't want them to judge me, you know, and the team here is more like, you know, okay, here's what you can expect. This is what might happen. Ooh, that's really challenging and unique. Or we think you should call back to your licensing worker because that's not a problem, you know, something we can answer.
So, another question relates to children that are already in your home. You already have children.
Mm-hmm.
How do you talk with them about becoming a foster family?
Yeah, I would say that, again, it should be, you know, and I hate to use shoulds, it's best to have a conversation of as a family to the degree that's possible. And being aware of that, because it is going to change the dynamics in your home and, you know, and your availability and what your intentions are. What's really, really important is that to the degree possible, we create an environment in your home where the children coming in don't feel like they have some kind of secondary class status or, you know, something like that. These are things we've heard from youth, that in certain situations, not all, but in some homes, they felt like they were not as good as. And, you know, so how are you going to provide individual care while treating everybody as an active member of that family? So, you know, that's a lot of what people have to work through day in and day out with, you know, all the children in their home in that kind of special, unique family situation. But what I've said before is that many folks find that, you know, their kids will, you know, adapt, help, you know, that they also build connections with kids that come into the home, and it can sometimes be really, you know, tough on them when that gets broken up as well. So it's usually, we hear a lot more positive stories than we hear any really horrible situations, but I'm sure if we sat on here long enough, Larry, somebody would find one.
I would think the hardest thing for if I was a foster parent and had spent months and, you know, a lot of time, the hardest thing for me would be to say goodbye.
Yeah.
You'd feel good if the person, if the youngster was going back, but there'd be a big lump in my throat. I'm pretty sure of that. Because there would be a lot of positive experiences I would probably be drawing on. And I want to thank you so much, Oriana. Your Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families has a great website. We'll post it up on our today's program at WPR.org/Larry so people can link it. But if you just type in Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, you're going to find a lot of really good information that is going to help you make the decision, perhaps, to become a foster parent. Oriana, thank you for what you do, and thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry, for having me on this show, and thank you for all your listeners who are tuning in. Have a great day.
Oriana Carey is CEO of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families. Take a look at their website. It's really fascinating and interesting. Coming up, we're going to talk about investing for retirement. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking about everything you need to know about buying and selling stocks and saving for retirement with our guest, Martha Klatt. Martha is a financial advisor with Carlson Advisors. It's a Ameriprise private wealth advisory practice in Toma, Wisconsin. She's also a managing partner of the company, and her areas of focus include investment management, retirement planning strategies, women's financial strategies, and a whole lot more. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Do you feel confident with your retirement saving plan? Do you have a plan to save for retirement? What about investing in the stock market? Waiting for your call. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Martha Klatt, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me as your guest.
I tell you what, we've got a, given your background, I think we've got a lot of things to talk about. Let's take the stock market just to begin with. It had some fluctuations in gains and losses. I went to your site, I think in the first half of this year, the gains were primarily coming from some of the tech stocks. But what's the volatility or what's causing it?
Yeah, the tech stocks have been driving the market. They've been kind of sending it up. There's a lot of interest in artificial intelligence, which is some of the areas that people are interested in. Some of the driving forces in the market volatility are just basically, you know, people not knowing what's going on. It's an election year that has a little bit of an impact on it, not a impact that's going to remain. You know, just what's going on with the wars and the debt and everything. The market is actually forward thinking, so it looks ahead. But with people, and you know, you see the market and things happen and you don't understand what's happening, and that makes people uneasy.
Yeah, that and that leads to fluctuations up and down.
Right.
Here I already have a couple of questions. What's the difference between stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Email here.
Okay. Well, stocks are something that an individual company, you buy a stock in an individual company. A bond is usually where a company or in a municipality or something like that is looking to borrow money. So they issue a bond. You buy the bond that gives the person that issued it money to do research, expand, whatever. And then they pay you a dividend and some interest to own that bond. And then mutual funds, I like to describe those as baskets of different products. So you can buy a mutual fund that has all stocks, or you can buy a mutual fund that has a mixture of stocks and bonds, or you can buy one that has all bonds. So if there's a, you know, they all work together, but they are different types of products.
Yeah. And typically, well, I shouldn't say typically, more often than not, do people choose to invest in maybe a broader range so you've got a little of everything in there?
I think people are probably more familiar with mutual funds, just because a lot of retirement plans use those, because you can take a smaller amount of money and be more diversified, you know, by just buying one product. But a lot of people also like to, you know what they own, and if they like to do that, then they usually will buy individual stocks.
And if you look at the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, I think there are more than 6,000 different stock options out there.
And yeah, so, there's a lot of products and a lot of different ways that you can invest.
How do you go about picking, or how should you approach picking stocks if you're doing that?
Well, what I do is, you know, I really have to get to know my client. I have to, before I'm going to invest their money, I want to know, you know, kind of what their goals are, what they're looking to do. What's the end game? You know, what do they want to do with this money? Then that gives me a good idea of what kind of product I can go into. I also take a look at, you know, how comfortable are they with the stock market? You know, there's some stocks that can be a little bit more volatile, or there's some stocks that don't grow a lot but pay a dividend. So it's really important, because we certainly don't want to invest anybody's money and have them not be able to sleep at night because they're worried about, you know, the market.
That's for sure. Well, any advisors that I've used, most say, don't worry about a sudden drop or a sudden increase. If you're in the market and you've maybe bought the market, just stay with the ups and the downs, and over time the ups, the market will rise.
Right. You know, there's so many things that can impact short term. You know, just all of a sudden a lot of people selling, or, you know, something happens in the, you know, the United States or overseas or something that can make the market a little nervous. So we try to make sure that people really don't react emotionally, even though, you know, all of us, even myself, you know, you see your portfolio go down and your heart kind of clutches and you're like, oh no, you know, that's not what I want. But it's really difficult to time the market. So you want to keep in mind, any time that you're thinking about making a transaction to buy or sell, again, go back to, you know, what's my goal for this money? What's my long-term objective here? And try to stay within that plan that you put forth, and only, you know, make the trades or something if it's a reason, because it will get you to your end game the way you want to, not because the market's up or down today and I should, you know, my heart's telling me I should probably do something. That's usually the wrong time to do something.
Peter in Nina says he has $20,000 in a savings account. He'd like to put it in something that has a better return. Thinking about doing this online, is that safe?
I think you, with anything, with any time you do any type of you know, business with anything, you have to do your research. So you have to check out, you know, the company that you're going to work with. You can go, you know, ask people for referrals, how, you know, if they've had good experience with that. As far as advisors, you can go to FINRA and do a broker check, which will tell an investor if that person has any complaints or if there's anything out there that they should know about. But it is really important to understand the company that you're going to work with, understand how the process works, what the fees are going to be, and, you know, clearly, you know, what you have to do as opposed to what the firm is going to do.
Richard in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, there's a, it's too late for me because I've been through two divorces. And I lost my retirement. I lost a house or two. So what recommendations, because especially some states are worse than others, and Wisconsin doesn't favor the man as much as it does the woman, that's my opinion. And what recommendations, if any, you can help other people that ended up in my position that shouldn't, for working their whole life?
So how to protect yourself from losing all your money during a divorce, I guess, is the question.
Wow, good question. You know, I would say the important thing during the divorce is that you work with those subject matter experts, that you meet with your financial, if you don't have a financial advisor, it would be, you know, probably smart to get a financial advisor, and then also get an advisor that will work with, you know, your lawyer and your accountant. You know, every situation is different. So, you know, what you would want to do is have that team of support people working in your best interest to come out with the, you know, the best interest, best outcome that we can based on, you know, what is expected of you, what you legally have to do, and, you know, kind of what you want to do. But there's no one answer. And as far as, you know, being too late, I wouldn't say it's too late. I would say, you know, always invest in yourself. You know, you always want to try to pay yourself, even if it's just a little bit. You'd be surprised how fast just a little bit of money will add up.
Yeah, it's we talk about that. You know, there's different stages in your life as you go along. I mean, you hopefully you start early.
That's the best. You know, that would be the best way, is if you can start as early as possible. Some people teach their kids right away to start, you know, as they get any money, babysitting money, birthday money, that type of thing. They'll teach them, you know, that you're going to save some, you're going to spend some, you're going to donate some, and then you're going to invest some. You know, ideally, that's the best practice, because then by the time they get to a point where they're going to be actually earning a paycheck, they already have that ingrained that this is just what I do with my paycheck. But you do want to try to, you know, you think of it as paying yourself. You know, you want to take care of yourself, because that's going to give you options in the future.
And what happens when I guess it's never too late, but if you're, let's say you're 50 years old and you haven't invested, so you're maybe 10, you're probably 12 to 15 years out from retirement. What about that end?
Yeah, when you get to that point, like you said, it is never too late. Mm-hmm. It's just that sometimes when you start later like that, you may have to adjust your goals or your timeline. It all comes down to, you know, where is that roadmap going to take you? And we do a lot of financial planning that provides that kind of GPS for people, that allows them to look at their short-term goals and their long-term goals and work towards the things they have to do to get there. And if you start later in life, you know, unfortunately, that sometimes means that you either have to adjust those goals, you might have to work longer, or you might have to try and save more at one time, where if you're younger, you can start with just saving, you know, a little bit. And over the years, that's going to work for you. When you start later, you don't have as much working for you, so you have to maybe save more at the time, or look at what you're trying to do and kind of adjust it to make it work.
Our guest today, Martha Klatt, financial advisor with Carlson Advisors in Toma, Wisconsin, talking about investing and investing for retirement with Martha. Questions for her, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Give a call or send an email. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your finances and retiring and investing for retirement with our guest today, Martha Klatt, financial advisor with Carlson Advisors in Toma, Wisconsin. Great to have her with us. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Tom emailed to ask, what are annuities? Explain annuities. And if you're in one, how do you get out of it?
So annuities are insurance products. And there are all different kinds of insurance products. You have your, you know, your different insurances, your life insurance, your car insurance, all of those types of things. But annuities are a life insurance product that can invest your money. And like I said, there's every annuity is kind of different. You have to really look at the prospectus and find out what it is. Some annuities will, they will invest in the market. Some will provide an income stream. Some are just investment products where, you know, you're just basically growing the annuity. And at some point in time, you know, it would be part of your estate. Other annuities you contribute to, and then they give you a certain amount of income down the road based on kind of the cash value in the account. So I would just say with, if you're using annuities, you know, just make sure you understand the product, understand what it's going to do for you, because like I said, some will provide income, some do not. To get out of them, I would say that you want to talk to either your financial advisor or your insurance, you know, the person that sold you the annuity. I guess you want to look at why you're leaving, you know, why you want to get out of the annuity. You also want to check and see if there's any surrender fees. Annuities sometimes require that you keep the money in there for so many years, and then every year that surrender fee will go down. So you really want to be conscious before you do anything of what that surrender fee is.
So I imagine there are some portfolios that have, they might have 401ks, they might have IRAs and annuities, all of them. And there's some that exist, as you were talking about, just on their own. What's the best way to create an investment portfolio?
You know, it's fine. It's really smart to be diversified. So it's not unusual for people to have different products. And it's, you know, it is common for people to have, say, a 401k plan or some type of work retirement plan. And then also maybe be saving for their kids for college or have a Roth account, something like that. I would say you want to, again, understand what your outcome is, what you're trying to, you know, achieve, and then also diversify and buy quality is my most important advice, is just to make sure you know what your own.
And maybe you could tell, you mentioned Roth IRAs, maybe talk about the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional one, and maybe why one would be better than the other.
So the difference in your IRAs are your Roth IRA is a retirement account that you put your money in after you pay taxes. And then there's some rules that go along with a Roth IRA, like you need to keep it in there 2 years, and or you, if you withdraw it, there's some penalties. But basically the premise of a Roth is that if you put that money in there and leave it until retirement, then all your gains or all the dividends that you get or the capital gains that you might get in that account are tax-free. Then everything in your Roth, when you withdraw that, you do not have to pay state and federal income tax on it or capital gains. If you have just a regular IRA, you're putting that money in before it's taxed, so that when you draw that out, it goes against, it counts as earned income for you on your income tax, and then you have to pay state and federal taxes on it.
So on the face of it, it sounds like if you've got your choice, a Roth IRA would be better if you're not going to have to pay taxes on it.
Yeah, you just look at, you know, kind of look at your cash flow is, you know, do you need that tax deductible now? Or, you know, can you take it? Would you rather have it later in life? And, you know, with the environment that we live in right now, you know, I don't see taxes going down in the near future. So, you know, that would make sense to, you know, go ahead and, you know, put your money into a Roth, because you're paying the taxes now, and then everything you earn on it, you don't have to pay taxes.
Yeah. And what percentage, you may have mentioned it and I might have just missed it, but what percentage of your money can you put into a Roth IRA?
So a Roth IRA, every year the IRS will tell you how much you can put in. This year, if you're under 50, it's $7,000. And I believe if you're over 50, you can put in a little bit more. I believe it's 8,000, but don't quote me on that. I'll have to check. But every year you just have to check and see with your advisor or with the IRS and see what their limit is. Now, with a Roth, there also are some income levels. So depending on how much you earn, you may not be eligible to contribute to a Roth. So there's some information that you have to find out before you would do that.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage of savings should you consider investing?
You know, I think that's different for every person. I think you want to, you certainly don't want to make it a cash flow issue. So, I mean, if you can't afford to pay your bills and everything like that, you have to take that into consideration. But I do think if you can, you always want to do something. There's no magic number of, you know, any type of percentage or anything like that. It's very individualized. But if you think about it, the more you do, you know, the more you do sooner, the better it's going to work for you longer. I always suggest, especially with my younger clients, to do something and then look at it as, you know, when you get that bonus or that raise, then bump up the percentage that you're doing, because you're not used to having that money anyway. So, you know, take a little bit of that and pay it to yourself, but just try to keep increasing that over time.
Talk a little bit about 401ks, options to have when it comes to your 401k. Is at what age should people stop contributing maybe to their 401ks as well?
Well, I think if you're working with an employer that has a 401k plan, you certainly want to take an interest in it and find out about it. And, you know, most of the time you want to be contributing to it, because there often is a company match. So if you contribute to the plan, you know, the company may match some of the contributions. So if you don't participate, you kind of leave some money on the table and a benefit that's there for you. In a 401k, nowadays 401ks, you can do your contributions often either, you know, pre-tax or in the Roth component. So that's a nice benefit. And you know, again, how long should you contribute to it? It's kind of that whole, you know, kind of what you're trying to achieve. You certainly want to keep contributing something, at least the match, if you can, to get that company match. And then, you know, when you, that's where it comes into play, where it's really helpful if you're working with an advisor and doing a financial plan, because you can really map out, you know, kind of, if I want to, you know, do this at, you know, a certain age, I have to save this much and I have to do these things. And that can really help you plot that, you know, path to get there. But you certainly want to keep that balance. You don't want to make contributing to any type of, to anything, basically, where, you know, you can't afford to, you know, pay your bills or anything like that.
Yeah, you need to be paying your bills, that's for sure, and including credit card, because the credit card, I make it a point to never run a balance on my credit cards, because the interest rates on that are, you're just losing money if you do that.
Yeah, if you just pay the minimum on your credit cards, it's really difficult to to ever get that credit card paid off. So, I mean, there is good debt and bad debt. You know, there are times when you do want to take on some loans or have a little bit of debt, but you want to be really conscious of how much that's costing you and how long you're going to be paying that.
Yeah, that's for sure. Martha Klatt, our guest today, financial advisor. Give a call with your questions. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. It's kind of interesting to me that you, one of your areas of focus include women's financial strategies. Talk about that and how that may be different from men's financial strategies.
Yeah. Well, I think women are totally able and knowledgeable in the investment world, but culturally, sometimes, you know, it's a case of where it's changing, but in the past, sometimes women have been more taking care of everybody else as opposed to them, where men will be more likely to, you know, participate in their 401k plans or, you know, put money in savings or something like that. Women will be, you know, putting their kids through different activities or that type of thing. They tend not to take care of themselves first. And then I think the other thing is, you know, sometimes men and women just think differently. So the way that men would choose to invest is different from the way that women might choose to invest. And it's not a right or wrong type of thing. It's just we do things differently. You know, you might have somebody that says, you know, I see this product all the time and I'm always using it. So, you know, I thought maybe I want to buy some of that. And, you know, otherwise, you know, other people, you know, might see something that's pretty flashy and think, oh, I got to get on that because that's exciting. So it's just a matter of kind of different ways we think and different ways then we react to what we're doing. And sometimes in the past, and that, like I said, it's changing a lot because, you know, kind of our roles and everything are changing. But, you know, sometimes some women can be more cautious or more conservative. And so maybe they are. So that's where it helps to work with an advisor and everything to make sure that you're taking on the right amount of risk for the time horizon that you have. And the same thing holds true for men. But there's just that little bit of difference sometimes where women sometimes will be a little bit more cautious.
Yeah, yeah. Don in Madison has a comment for us. Don, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. And I just want to say that in the late 1970s, I was a new state employee, state of Wisconsin, and just out of grad school, I had no money at all, of course. But I was convinced to start depositing in a deferred compensation account, and it has turned out to be absolutely wonderful. So I'd encourage anybody starting out, even if you don't have much of a cash flow, do that, because I started with $10 per paycheck deposited and wish I would have done 100 if I could have afford it. So. Yeah. Thank you.
Don, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Martha?
Yeah, I think Don is exactly right. That's why I tell people to, you know, always try to do something. You know, it's not so important the amount that you're doing, just that you're taking that first step and doing something to prepare yourself for the future. And anything you do, you know, is going to just give you options down the road. And you know, I like to talk to my clients about, you know, kind of thinking about it in like three buckets of money. You know, you could do some in the Roth where, you know, you You don't pay any taxes when you take it out. Some in the IRA where, or the 401k plan where the employer's contributions will be taxed when you take it out. And then you may have savings or checking or, you know, an investment account that's not related to retirement at all. And if you're doing some of that diversification with your funds, that's just going to give you more options down the road. It may allow you to retire early. It may allow you to take that dream vacation you've always wanted. It just is kind of setting you up for success. And it also is setting you up to be able to deal with life events as they happen.
Don, thanks again for calling. Wendy in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering what strategies, you'd recommend to determine how much you need for retirement.
Okay, so I do a financial plan for my clients where we really take a look at where we are now. We talk about what the short-term goals are, what the long-term goals are, and factor in, you know, kind of what they're making now, how much they can save. And then from there, I wish I could say you do this strategy, but I can't because it's so individualized. But we're able to usually come up with a plan of action that, the client can, do this much or save this much in a savings account or put this much in their 401k plan. And go forward that way. And then in doing the financial plan with my clients, then we revisit that on at least an annual basis where it's like, is this still important to you? Is this still our goal? Are we meeting this goal? Do we have to adjust our priorities or what we're doing? So I know that's kind of not an answer to your question, but it is very individualized. And I would just say, if you're wondering that, it would be really important to try to find, if you're not working with an advisor, to, maybe find an advisor that can give you that guidance.
And just talking about finding an advisor, I guess you could ask friends, but what are the ways to find a financial advisor for you?
Well, I think asking friends, talking to people that work with advisors and finding out, advisors that they like, that they feel are trustworthy, that they're, knowledgeable on what they're doing. If you get a name, like I said, you can always go to the FINRA broker check site, and that will tell you kind of, what the history of that advisor is, if there's any complaints. And I would also say to do your research. In this day of technology, you can go on and Google. Most advisors have websites that'll give you a good idea of, kind of who they are, the company they work with, if they have any staff or a team. But you do want to, I think the most important thing, and don't hesitate to, set up a phone call or a meeting with an advisor and go meet with them, because I think it's important that you find the right person. You have to work with somebody that you're comfortable with, that you trust, and that you feel comfortable to ask questions. If you're working with somebody that you think, if I ask this question, I'll feel dumb or something like that, that's not the right person. You have to work with somebody that's going to collaborate with you, that's going to be a partner with you and make those decisions together.
Email from Brian. He wants to do some improvements on his home. Should he look into a second mortgage or should he take money out of his investment accounts?
So if one of my clients came in and asked that, what I would do would be to, kind of look at their total financial picture, take a look at the interest that they're going to pay on the loan, and take a look at the interest that they're, what they're maybe making on their investment account, and, other things that would maybe pertain to their particular life. And then with the client, make a decision on, what is the best option. it's hard to say. You know, some people don't like debt. So the thought of taking out a second mortgage would, you know, be one of those things that they'd be really uncomfortable with. Some people think, you know, if I'm making more in my investment account than I would be paying on my loan, that possibly that would be the right option. So there's really no right or wrong answer. It's more, again, kind of what you're comfortable with and what makes sense for your financial plan.
Yeah. Bob in Brookfield emailed to ask if you could discuss U.S. government-issued I-bonds and how the interest rate that they pay is determined.
You know, I don't do a lot of I-bonds because you buy those right from the government. So it's not something that we go out there and buy. So I could get back to you with some information on that, but I don't really have all the details on it.
Yeah, and somebody else wonders, what would you tell someone who came to you and said they wanted to invest in real estate?
You know, like anything else, you know, you can take a look. Again, you have to do your homework. You have to understand, you know, what company you're investing in. Take a look at their financials. You know, do they have pretty good financials? Is the company in debt or that type of thing? There's a lot of different types of products that you can use to invest in real estate. And sometimes within some of your mutual funds or your portfolios, you may have a small allocation in a lot of different sectors. You may own a lot of different things. So you just want to make sure you know what you own.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. Wanted to turn to saving for children or for kids through college, and saving for retirement at the same time. what advice do you have there?
Well, I think you really want to balance that. Sometimes our instinct as parents is to, you know, we got to take care of our kids and we've got to, you know, open up an education account or some type of savings account for our kids to, you know, help them in the future. But you really do have to take care of yourself. And then if you can, you also want to take care of the kids. So you want to balance that out. And the reason I say that is because, you know, when you hit retirement age and want to retire, or if life happens as you get older, you don't have as many options at that point in time. Where for a child, if you're starting a savings account or an education account, you know, anything is probably going to help. But down the road, they have a longer timeline of being able to save for that type of thing than you might for retirement. So, you know, I keep saying that, but you kind of look at that time horizon, you know, where you are in life and your cash flow. But I would always suggest that you always try to, you know, keep taking care of yourself. And then in addition, you know, allocate, you know, funds to other things that you want to do. So, you know, if one of your goals is to help your child pay for education down the road, then, you know, you certainly want to try to do that. But you want to do it in kind of a realistic way that, you know, you're kind of not taking it away from you or your retirement or your ability to retire to provide them education. You want to try to do both if you can, or to time it so that, you know, for this many years, I'm going to contribute this much to, you know, whatever product. And then, you know, in that time frame, then I'm going to, you know, kind of my focus is going to change to this. I mean, you can do all kinds of different things, but you do want to, you know, kind of take care of yourself too.
Yeah, for sure. Somebody else was just asking now in an email, do you recommend the Edvest 529 college savings plan?
I don't have any specific recommendations. There's a lot of good products out there. When looking at education funds, I would say, you know, talk to an advisor. There's differences in education funds. Some of them, you know, pay for different things. Some states have certain education funds that the state will give sometimes a tax credit for. But there's a lot of different, and there's a lot of different ways that you can save for education for kids. So it kind of goes again to kind of what your lifestyle is and what the kids are going to do.
Amen to that. Our guest today, Martha Klatt, financial advisor with Carlson Advisors in Tomo, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at saving for retirement and other investment strategies with our guest, Martha Klatt from Carlson Advisors in Tomo, Wisconsin. Great to have her along. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Got a lot of good emails over the course of the show. I would just mention in passing that when my daughter was born at about the same time, I came into sort of a from a death $15,000, and I talked to my financial advisor about putting it into a 529 account. And she said, "I've got one for you that'll ought to double every 5 or 6 years," and so I put it all in, and it did, and she wound up with a lot of money. That more than enough to cover her college education. So it was quite a relief to have that money when the 18 years later came and it was time for her to go on to college.
And I know sometimes parents or grandparents will question, to contribute to a 529, what if they don't go to school or that type of thing? And if you're in a 529, you can always change the beneficiary to other kids, or they can use it for apprenticeships on, supervisory courses they may take. It's not just for young kids and, going to college. But just recently, they've changed the rules, too, on 529s that if the kids don't use the total amount for education, now they can use a certain amount of it can be rolled into a Roth. You have to roll it in over a few years because you have to meet the guidelines of the Roth contributions. But that's a very nice feature that they've added to the 529. So now if people say, well, what if they don't use all their money for education, it's a wonderful product that they can be now saving also for their retirement or for that it could go into a Roth account, which would be beneficial down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathy in Viroqua has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I'm wondering if your guest could talk about socially responsible investments. I had heard that term some years ago, and I was wondering what the current if that's something to consider still.
Yeah, that's a very definitely a client preference. If I have a client that, wants to invest, but there's certain companies or certain types of things that they just don't believe in, or, kind of go against what they want to do, then we certainly, try to accommodate that. And there is, there's a lot of, when we do research what we're going to invest our clients in, we are able to look and see, are they military? Do they, use tobacco or that type of thing are some of the common ones that, people will look at. And we're able to structure a portfolio, if that's the client's wishes, with those types of investments. So it is out there. I think certain people want that. And, as an advisor, you want to accommodate that. So we do have different products that would address that.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Kathy. Thank you. Linda in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, great show again, Larry, as usual. Question here. Tina, I came in late to the program, and I know you were talking about Roth IRAs. Can you also do a SEP Roth IRA and then also a traditional at the same time?
You have to be careful. If you're doing an IRA and a Roth, you can only contribute up to that $7,000. So you can only, if you put $4,000 in a Roth, you can only put $3,000 in an IRA. Now, if you're in some type of retirement program, you can oftentimes still be doing a Roth or an IRA. But again, there are some restrictions, some wage guidelines that, we have to be conscious of to make sure that, if you're making a certain amount, you may not be able to do it. So that would be a good question, a reason to maybe seek out somebody if you're not working with somebody to have them, go over that with you. But it is possible to save in different types of accounts.
Thank you, Linda, for calling. Gil has a question. How much would it cost to hire a financial planner?
It varies from, I think from business to business. Oftentimes, there's different ways that I would say people charge fees. Sometimes you have a product fee. Sometimes there's a management fee and and oftentimes in brokerage accounts, they'll have what they call a commission. Again, it's a question when you meet with somebody that you're thinking about investing your money with that you want to have that conversation. Just exactly what is the cost? How do you get paid? Where does that money go? And, how does that relate in comparison to the product you're going to put me in? I mean, the expectation always is, my client should make more than whatever they're paying me most of the time. You do have sometimes really down markets where there might be a blimp or something in that. But for the most part, you want to understand what fees you're paying. And an advisor should be, relatively transparent on that. They should be willing to tell you exactly what they're going to charge. And it varies from what services you provide. Sometimes you're not providing, you're just doing maybe one thing, and other times you may be doing multiple type of things for a client. So, that will make the price vary a little bit.
Yeah, but you should be able to say, okay, I'm for every $1,000 I invest, how many dollars, given this, am I going to be paying you for your services, for example?
Right. That's part of our conversation when we meet with prospects, for sure. It's kind of like, okay, this type of service will cost you this type of service will cost you that. But then once they are clients, we still have that conversation. We still, go over what it is costing, and are they still comfortable with that? And if we're looking to do something different, what's that going to cost, and how is that different from what they're currently doing? So it very definitely is a conversation you should have, and you should know what you're paying.
Well, Martha, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for spending time with us. I had a few more questions, but we're out of time. So there you go. Thank you. Thank you very much, Martha, for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And let me know if you have any questions. I have a website you can go to if you want to find information.
So. And the website is?
If you just Google Martha Klatt at Ameriprise, you'll go right to it.
Martha Klatt, financial advisor from Carlson Advisors in Toma, Wisconsin, our guest today. Great to have her with us. And great to have you with us as well. And I'm grateful for the team of people we've got. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn. Our executive director is Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on the show, Garden Talk, Neil DeBole returns to help you with your native gardening questions. And then we'll talk about the importance of soil quality. In the meantime, stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.